So this is a work to appear hopefully this month sometime. And this is with Tudor de Maufetet. And Sasha Goncharov. Okay, so as an introduction, one motivation is that the theory of M5 brain is still quite mysterious. The 6D theory, the so-called 2.0 theory, is still difficult to study directly, and we don't even know if there's a Lagrangian description. So one approach which has been successful recently is to compactify this theory on some manifolds of various dimensions and study the resulting effective gauge theories, which are more familiar. So this allows to understand what's going on by this compactification. And also this gives rise to an interesting correspondence between the geometry of the manifold on which we compactify and the physics of the gauge theory that results from this compactification. So it's some sort of new geometry physics correspondence. Okay. Yes, so we take the 6D 2.0 theory of M5 brains. And then we compactify on some manifold M, and we obtain a lower dimensional gauge theory that we can call DM. So one very famous and successful example of such a procedure is to take M to be a Riemann surface and to compactify the M5 brain theory on this Riemann surface to get a four-dimensional CFT, n equal to CFT. So this was explained by Davide in 2009. And then there's also this correspondence, the so-called AGT correspondence by Davide, Alde, and Tashikawa, which relates Liouville theory on the Riemann surface to objects like the partition function of the four-dimensional CFT. So in this talk, what I look at is the case where the manifold M is three-dimensional. So it's a correspondence between the geometry of three manifolds and the physics of 3D CFTs. So we take M to be a three-manifold. And it has SLK Trans-Simons theory on it. Oops. So this K is the number of M5 brains that we wrap on these three manifolds. And then this gives 3D gauge theories that have n equal to supersymmetry, and they're abelian. They have abelian gauge groups. Tm. And just like in the AGT correspondence, we can check that objects on both sides match. So for example, the partition function of the Trans-Simons theory on M will be equal to the partition function on the ellipsoid, on the squashed three sphere for the corresponding 3D gauge theory. And we can also match on both sides moduli spaces. So the moduli space of flat connections on M will match the moduli space of vacua of the CFT. Okay, so that's the general context of this talk. Okay, so the outline will be first to talk about the simplest three manifold, and it's just a tetrahedron. So this the idea is to decompose the three manifold M into elementary building blocks. So this is like a 3D triangulation. If you were considering a Riemann surface, it would be like triangulating the Riemann surface. But in 3D, the simplices are tetrahedron. So the strategy is to first study this compactification on a tetrahedron, and then to understand what happens when we glue such tetrahedra together. So I'll be looking first at just taking two tetrahedra and gluing them on a common face, and we'll see that there is an interesting independence on the choice of triangulation of the three manifold that arise. And finally, we'll look at an interesting class of three manifolds, which is knot complements. So typically knot complement in S3, so you take S3 and you take a knot defect on it, and you remove the neighborhood of this knot in S3, so it's like a torus that surrounds the knot, and so this gives you this large class of three manifolds. Okay. So first section is looking at tetrahedron. Okay, so you see this is my representation of the tetrahedron. It's like you have four faces, four vertices, and this is the building block that will be glued together. And in fact, so we're looking at a so-called ideal tetrahedra. So it means that the vertices are really removed. So we don't consider the vertices to be part of this tetrahedron. So if we can just cut out the vertices, and what is left is a little triangle here instead of the vertex. So for each vertex, you have a little triangle like this. This will have its importance later on. And as I said, there is a Chern-Simons theory in it. So it's SLK for KM5 brains wrapped, and it's a complex SLK. Chern-Simons. So the classical solutions are flat connections. And the flat connections are determined by the holonomies on the three manifold. And so a nice useful way to describe the holonomies is to introduce some coordinates on the tetrahedron. So I'll first look at the case of two M5 brains for simplicity. Two M5, so this is SL2. It's the rank one case, the simplest one. And in that case, it's enough to introduce just one coordinate for each edge of the tetrahedron. So there's six edges, and we introduce six coordinates. So I'll call them z, z prime, and z prime prime, and this one y, y prime, and y prime prime. And so this gives you a way to compute the holonomy on the surface. So if you have a path that loops around the top vertices like this, so you go around this vertex here, and you want to compute the holonomy around this. So we'll call this path gamma. So the holonomy along gamma will be SL2 matrix with eigenvalues lambda, and it's triangular, and from now we don't care about what is here. And this eigenvalue lambda is just given by the coordinates that are met by this path around this vertex. So in that case, it's z times z prime times z prime prime. Well, okay, in fact, this is a minus sign, really. So what you find in the end is minus z, z prime, and z prime prime. So the coordinates are really minus here, but it doesn't matter too much. So on the boundary.
On the boundary.
Yes.
The
not yet. So I should say this. So first, I look at connections on the boundary, and then I'll look at the subset of such connections that extend to the interior of the tetrahedron. So for the boundary flat connections. So the space of flat connections on the boundary of the tetrahedron, so delta means tetrahedron, and this d of delta is the boundary of the tetrahedron, and it's modulo gauge equivalence. So this set of flat connections, I'll call it P, and this is parameterized by the unipotent holonomies around the vertices. So it means that lambda has to be 1. So in terms of equation, it will be z, z prime prime equals to minus 1.
This is part of the definition of the tetrahedron. So that requiring unipotent holonomy.
Okay. So what is the other part? Oh, I see. Well, it has to be a constant, but this constant is set to 1 by choice, or?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's set to 1. Right. Oh, sorry. Right.
Sorry?
I mean, if you didn't look at all, how many you had a defect going into this idea, you
know. Yes, yes. You want a constant, and it is set to 1 by convention, I guess.
When you put this defect of minus 1, so when the problem is really important.
Yes. Yes, I see, okay. Yeah, that's a good perspective on this, yes. So, okay, in fact, I cheated a little bit because, so here you have four vertices, so there's four paths that you can take like this. And as it stands, they all involve different coordinates. So for example, this path here will be y times z prime prime times y prime. But once you've imposed similar condition for each of them, then this implies that this y is actually equal to the z, and this one is equal to the z prime prime, and this one is equal to z prime. So you start with six coordinates but then imposing this holonomy constraint, you end up with just three, and there's one remaining constraint like this. So it's a two-dimensional space. Okay, so I can tell you this. So there's a nice interpretation of those z coordinates. So first you have to go to log coordinates. So the logarithmic coordinates will be the capital letter z, and it is it's such that the small z are the exponential of the big z. So those are logarithmic coordinates. So in terms of those coordinates, you can interpret the those coordinates on the edges as being the torsion. So this is the torsion of the hyperbolic metric as you go across the edge like this. And then, but the important part is the dihedral angles. So this is the angle between the two faces at the edge. And what this constraint is saying in terms of those logarithmic coordinates is that the sum So the sum of the coordinates that you meet when you go around a vertex has to be I pi. So this means no torsion, and then the sum of the angles is pi. So the little triangles here, this little triangle with the coordinates z, well, big one, z prime and z prime prime, the sum of those three angles is pi. So it means it's a Euclidean triangle and there's no torsion. So this is how you can understand this this minus one, so that it's just e to the I pi.
In terms of cross ratios, I think you were saying that the SO2C is the same as having a hyperbolic metric on
this. Yes, there's this interpretation, yeah. Yeah.
In terms of cross ratios, kind of the natural symmetric, so these are also cross ratios of some vectors in C2. And there's the natural way of building cross ratios is happens to have an extra minus sign. So you're canceling three things, and then at the end you have to. It's kind of an annoying little fact of life. Or in order to take logarithms consistently, you take the logs of the z's, not the logs of
the z. Yeah, it just happens that it's like this, it's minus one in terms of cross ratios, yeah. Okay, so. So I said this space is two-dimensional, and in fact, it's a symplectic space. So there is a symplectic form on this boundary space P, and so it's a phase space. And in terms of those log coordinates, it takes the simple form dz wedge dz prime. And because of this relation, it's also equal to the cyclic permutation of the prime. So it's also this and the third one. So this is this space here is a phase space that is the set of flat connections on the boundary of the tetrahedron. But what we're really interested in is the flat connections in inside as well on the 3D space. So to describe this, maybe I should write over there. Okay. So now I call this space L delta, and that's the set of flat connections on the tetrahedron. So boundary and interior, and also modulo gauge equivalence. And for this, you need the holonomies to be trivial. So this is because what used to be a non-contractible loop around the vertex here, in the interior you can contract it. So it has better be trivial in order for this space to be smooth. And so there's an equation that guarantees this. And it's it looks like this. So z prime prime plus z inverse minus 1 equals to 0. And again, there is the cyclicity of the primes like this. So this was what appears here in the off-diagonal part of the holonomy matrix. So you have this here and you set it to 0. So you just get this by computing the holonomy from that. And this space, so it's included into the boundary phase space, and in fact it's a Lagrangian. It's a Lagrangian submanifold in it. Okay. Oh, yes, yeah.
It's the field of connection.
Yes.
But it's really the space of flat dimensions equipped to the choice of taking vector which
yes.
Perfects. So when that connection becomes trivial, the choice of taking vector matters a lot.
Yes. And you have a CP1, I think, at each vertex. Okay. So that's the story for the case of two M5 brains wrapped on the tetrahedron. So, I should say that this correspondence in the case of two M5 brains has been worked out by Tudor, Davide, and Sergei. I forgot to mention this. So it's referred to as DGG sometime, in analogy to AGT. So in this talk, I should have said this earlier, but so this was done last year for the case of two M5 brains, and it's the general idea of this construction. And in this talk, in my work with Tudor and Sasha, we've extended this to any number of M5 brains wrapped on this three manifold, so higher rank gauge theories. So the general setup of the talk will be to explain what it is in the case of two M5 brains first, because it's the simplest, and then explain how this generalizes to a larger number of M5 brains that I call K.
Did you say that it's abelian?
Yes. Yeah. This is one of the specificities of those theories, is that even though you have you start with a non-abelian group in 6D, and you have a description in 3D which is abelian. So this is one of the surprising features of those theory. So they might certainly exist non-abelian descriptions, but those constructions give you naturally the abelian description. And it would be an interesting direction to see if we can get non-abelian descriptions from a similar construction. Yes, there's also, so in 3D you have this 3D mirror symmetry, and in some cases it relates gauge theories that with abelian gauge group to gauge theories with non-abelian gauge group. So there's a paper by Jaffaris and Yin, I think, and they study such a case of non-abelian mirror symmetry in 3D. And indeed, having an alternative construction for those theories which give you an abelian description will allow to have this a better understanding of what happens in those non-abelian 3D mirror symmetries. So you start with the same manifold, but you can get an abelian description and a non-abelian, and they're equivalent by some mirror duality. Okay, so I'll erase bits of it. And now I'll explain what happens to the tetrahedron when you have more brains on it. So higher rank, you get SLKC. So this is for K M5. So in that case, the holonomy is an SLK matrix. So it has roughly it has K minus one eigenvalues. So before we just had this lambda, and now we have a number of lambdas, k1 up to k minus 1. And still this is removed. So since we have more data to describe, the idea is to have more coordinates on the boundary of this tetrahedron. So this was done by Fock and Goncharov. In 2003, and so you can roughly think of those k minus one holonomy eigenvalues to be k minus one path around a vertex here. So you don't only have one path that you can do, but you have another one here and another one and so on, and you have k minus one of them. So on each edge, you introduce k minus one coordinates. So this will be z1, z2, z3, and the same thing here. You have z1 prime, z2 prime, and so on. And so if you call those paths gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, you compute the holonomy, say, of gamma 1 is again the product of the coordinates that you meet along the path. So you'll get the eigenvalue of this will be z1, z1 prime, and z1 prime prime. And then on the other level, you get those ones, and so on. They're all the same path in some sense. They're all really the same path, but you want to describe a range of eigenvalues for the same path. So I don't know. Yeah, you can say that you have some sort of vector of paths, or and I don't know, but you have a. Sorry. Yes, it's a K by K matrix. So it's SLK. It's a matrix, SLK matrix. Sorry?
It's triangular.
Yes. So you have zero and something here. The eigenvalues, yeah. So this is not really, I should say, eigenvalues of this thing. Okay? Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes, this was for SL2, and then this is for SL. Okay, but in fact, this is not the only coordinates that appear. You also have faces coordinates here. So what you get really, I need to draw for a while, something like this. Wait, I'm getting lost here. Okay, so a right, like this, and the one in the back like this. So what, that would be much simpler. Okay, so I'll draw a face like this, and yeah, that's good. So you don't have only the edge coordinates, but you have also coordinates that appears in the middle of the faces. So this is called by Falk and Gonchar a K triangulation. So it means not only you have the composition in triangles, but the triangles themselves are subtriangulated, and they have K minus one vertices on the edges, and those number of face coordinates. And so here's the same thing, you have this triangulation on each face. And so you introduce a lot of coordinates like this. And when you read off the holonomy eigenvalues for a specific path on a certain level, the level distant from the vertex, you pick also those face coordinates. So those holonomy eigenvalues will have more and more coordinates that are involved. And you need to set them all to one in order to have this this phase space. But there is a very nice alternative to this, is to see this tetrahedron as a pyramid of octahedra. So okay, so I'll draw it first for the SL2 case. So for the SL2, you just had one coordinate for each edge. And if you relate them by edges like this, you see that what you have is a octahedron. I don't know if it's easy to see, but I mean, you have four faces of the tetrahedron. So this gives you four such triangles. So this one, for example, and this one, for example, and then one below and one in the back. And then you also have four vertices. And for each of them, you have a triangle that's really in the interior. But you can also think of this as kind of a maximal truncation of the tetrahedron. So those little triangles there, you make them so big that they actually meet each other. And you get this one here, you get this one here, and two in the back, one here, one here. So you have four faces, four vertices, so it's a polyhedron with eight faces, so it's an octahedron. So I hope you can visualize this. So in this description, it's equivalent to talk about the tetrahedron for SL2 or an octahedron. And the octahedron has coordinates on its vertices. And on opposite vertices, it's identified coordinates. So here, well, it's a bit messy, but you can see that you have the same thing here. So you're just packing the octahedron on top of each other. Yes, it is k cube of them. In fact, the exact number is 1/6 k times k squared minus 1. And so the reason why it's a nice description is that for each octahedron, the phase space. Okay, sorry. So I'll use like maybe a little square like this to describe the octahedron. So the phase space is just the same as for the SL2 tetrahedron, and the Lagrangian is also the same. And when you want to describe this phase space, you just take the product of the phase spaces, which just look like this, for each of the octahedron that's contained into the tetrahedron. So it's not more complicated to describe the phase space for this decomposed tetrahedron than it is to take multiple copies of this this tetrahedron for SL2. Yes, I'm coming to this. So yeah, this is roughly what happens, but this is true for k equals to 3. But when it's bigger than k equals to 3, you have an extra difficulty. So if you look at if you slice the tetrahedron in this direction, the first one that you get is just a triangle. So this is fine. Then what you get is something like this, and then what you get is something up. Like this. And you see that here there is an interior point. So if you have if you have more stuff going down this, I mean, if you don't stop, if this is not the bottom, but there is something below this, then it means you have a point which is completely in the interior of the tetrahedron. It's completely inside. It doesn't touch the boundary at all. And in that case, so there is a coordinate which is associated to this, and it is given by going around the path like this, and then you pick up a coordinate for each of those six triangles. So typically this will give you a coordinate that we can call C, and it's a product of six coordinates coming from six different octahedra. And what you have to do in that case is a symplectic reduction, and you set those C to 2 pi I. So yes, but this is okay, this is the logarithmic version. Yeah, okay, so okay, right. So I should say this is the small C, and then the large C is the sum of Z1 to Z6. So again, this constraint here that is just 2 pi I means that there's no torsion when you go around this, and you just get the sum of the angles of all those corners is 2 pi. So you need this for a smoothness of the inside. And yes, okay, and the Lagrangian is also constructed by taking this quotient. And I should say also maybe is that the phase coordinates here are also defined by taking a path around this, and then it's a product of those three coordinates that are involved. So it's the three octahedra that touch the face point. Like this thing is touched by one octahedron on top of it and two below. So this is how you relate the face coordinates to the octahedra coordinates.
Yeah. These are attached to vertices of the octahedron.
Yes.
So that continues to be true. So the product of the six is the six vertices that touch at a point.
Yes. Yes, this symplectic quotient description was described by Tudor last year. Okay, so now this is the part of the correspondence which looks at the three manifold. But then we'll look at what is the corresponding gauge theory on the remaining three dimensions. So this is the gauge theory for just one tetrahedron. And so again, we start for the case of two M5s. Up. And in that case, the corresponding theory T delta is a theory with one chiral field, phi z, if we take this coordinate to be z. And it's coupled to a background U1 coupled and there is a joint Simons coupling also with level -1/2. So this is the prescription that was given by Tudor, Davide, and Sergei Gukov. It can be motivated in many, many different ways. So one way is to be sure that the partition functions will match on either side. So the partition functions for the joint Simons theory here will have to match the partition function of this theory. And it gives you some dialogues on each side that match perfectly. And you can also match the moduli spaces on both sides, and this is what you find. And there was a paper by Cecotti, Cordova, and Vaffa last year, in which they have some geometric argument to get this in terms of flows of zeros of the Seiberg-Witten differential along a flip. I don't need to really go into detail, but this can be motivated from many different directions and by different groups. Okay, and then for K M5, what you get, so this would be the T2 for two M5s, and then the TK. So as I said, the SLK, tetrahedron, is just this number, which I can call N octahedra, so this means N copies of SL2 case. So here it's the same thing. This TK theory is this N copies of the T2 theory, of this theory of one chiral field. And and the interpretation of the internal points inside the tetrahedron, these C's, in that context is that you add a superpotential to this theory. Superpotential W, and it's a sum over the internal points of operators OK, which are just products of chiral fields that corresponds to those coordinates. So in this case, it will be products of six chiral fields. And so this breaks the U1 symmetries under which the operator is charged. And I should say also that those operators can be, if you are lucky, then they're expressed in terms of elementary chiral fields. But sometimes you have to also involve some monopole operators in them, and then it's not too clear how to define them. Okay.
It's just
complicated. It's not clear when you have those hard edges thing, but it's, yeah. Okay, so this is the building block, and then we just have to glue them now in order to obtain more interesting three manifolds. So is there any question maybe now, before moving to the next section? All right. Okay, so Okay, so now we have two tetrahedra, and we're going to glue them along a common face. And then we get what is called a bipyramid. So I won't go into very much detail here, but so if you call the coordinates here r prime prime, and for this one you call them s. Before the gluing, the phase space will be product phase space of the r tetrahedron and s tetrahedron. So this is again in the case of SL2, just one coordinate for each edge. And then here you identify the coordinates that agree on this edge. So if you have here you have r prime prime, and here you have s. So this coordinate here will be r prime prime plus s. So you start with a set of independent coordinates, then you have a set of coordinates which mixes them, and you need to find a transformation from that phase space to this phase space here. So this phase space, and this is a symplectic transformation from one to the other, since it's a symplectic space. So the interpretation of this symplectic transformation in the gauge theory is so there's three possible operations that you can do corresponding to three generators of symplectic groups. So there's the so-called S transformation, which in terms of matrices it will look something like this. And this means that you gauge a U1 flavor symmetry. So in this case, when you're gluing, you're also gauging some global symmetries. Then there's the T operation, which is a triangular matrix like this with the matrix K, which is symmetric. And this just corresponds to adding some Trans-Simons terms at level K. And finally, there's a GL transformation. So in terms of matrix, you have a GL matrix U. And then this just redefines the U1 flavor symmetries. So in terms of this bipyramid, which is glued from those two tetrahedra, you get a theory with two chirals. And if the gluing that you choose involves one of those S transformation, then you get a gauged U1. So this is SQED. So you have a gauged U1 and two chirals of opposite charge. Yes? Yes. The constraint, maybe I was too quick. The constraint will be a superpotential term. No, because in SL2 case you have no internal point. So the constraint is the. No, but this is not the same as.
It's only one chiral per octahedron. You don't get one for each of the three Zs. You just get it for Z.
So you start with the three coordinates on the tetrahedra. You have this constraint and then that constraint. So in fact, when you consider the flat connections on the full tetrahedra, you have one coordinate. So this is one chiral. And then those one chiral in interior points like this have to satisfy an extra constraint. And this becomes a superpotential term. And you can have the same thing appearing when you glue things. For example, if we had a face coordinate here and one here, after we've glued them, then they're in interior. This means along the gluing, you have to add a superpotential to the gauge theory that you obtain. No, on the outer face, no, you don't have for the outer face. It's only for the interior points.
So you don't need the extra constraint for the coordinates?
Well, after the gluing of the coordinates on the faces, in this case, the points will now be in the interior. So here, this does not correspond to a superpotential before the gluing, but after the gluing, it's in the interior.
What do you mean by extra constraints? The holonomy eigenvalues? They're automatic points. So on every orthogonal octahedron, the product around the triangle is minus one. And then when you start putting them together, it's automatic that the holonomy eigenvalues around a big path can be decomposed into a bunch of small paths. So the big holonomy eigenvalue is also the one.
So the big path around this that picks up the phase coordinates, then they are automatically satisfied when you impose the constraint on individual octahedra at the time. So yeah, maybe I wasn't clear.
That's one of the advantages of cutting things up.
Yeah, exactly. This is why it's useful to decompose into octahedra. Well, because there is no.
Yes, it's true.
For SL2, there is no phase coordinate, so you can glue without adding a superpotential. But the. Yes. Yeah. The gluing that you operate doesn't always involve this S transformation. It's only if it does involve it that you're gauging. But you were asking about superpotential.
The superpotential constraint
is in different. Yes, okay, I'm coming to this. This is what I'm saying now. So, in fact, this bipyramid is very interesting because you can decompose it into two different ways. So, I've showed you one way, is a decomposition into two tetrahedra. But there is another way. Something like this. Well, let's see. Yeah. And then. So I don't know if you can see this, but now you have three tetrahedra, and you glue them together like this. So there is like a central edge. Oops. There's a central edge here, and you you glue this face with the face on the back here, and you glue that face with the face on the back here. I hope it's clear. I don't know. Maybe it's not too clear. But let's see. I mean, if you look at that central slice, then you have you cut it like this, and then you have this is part of one tetrahedron, this is part of another one, and this is the one in the back here. Okay. Voilà, ok, it's just two different ways you can build the same Bay Pyramid. And as I said, there is this internal edge here, and now you have a coordinate here for x of each of them. You can call them x, y, and z. And after the gluing, you have the central point here, or the one here, is bringing together those three coordinates. So in that case, you have a constraint, and the constraint is x, y, z, is the product of the three coordinates. And as I said, when you have a constraint, then this means you have a superpotential term, which will be phi x, phi y, and phi z. And this is the so-called XYZ model. So you have three chirals, and they have this superpotential. And it's a well-known fact that SQED and this XYZ model are related by this 3D mirror symmetry that I mentioned earlier. So this was work by Intrigator and Cyberg in 96-97. And the two theories that you get in the IR are equivalent because they're mirror dual. So this is great because then it means that for one three manifold, which is this bipyramid, it doesn't matter which choice of triangulation you make. You can decide to triangulate it into two tetrahedra or into three tetrahedra. You get two different theories, but in fact they're equivalent by 3D mirror symmetry. So it means that the theory that is defined by a specific three manifold is independent on the triangulation. It's a topological invariant of the manifold. Okay, so I think I'll skip this, but you can also do this. This is called the 2-3 move, because from a 2 tetrahedra decomposition, you go to a 3 tetrahedra decomposition. And you can also follow this for the higher rank case, where you have all those octahedra inside. You can go from 2 tetrahedra decomposition to the 3 tetrahedra decomposition by a sequence of 2-3 moves which corresponds to this XYZ model SQED correspondence. So it means you can decompose some higher rank mirror symmetries by looking stepwise at a sequence of low rank mirror symmetry. So it creates this infinite families of mirror duals, but they all boil down to the very well-known mirror symmetry. Okay, and I think I'll just finish by mentioning some fully glued manifold, which are not complements. So you take S3, as I explained, and then you consider a line defect in it along a knot, and then you remove the tubular neighborhood of this knot. So you have this neighborhood is topologically T2, so you have a three manifold with a T2 boundary. So for example, the figure 8 knot, something like this. No, sorry, this is the trefoil. So this is the trefoil. Or you have the figure 8, which is something like this. And so for each knot, you can do this. And there is a way to find the triangulation of such knot complements in terms of tetrahedra, which this began with the work of Thurston in the 80s. And so, for example, I show you the complement of this knot, the figure eight knot. So you remember that the vertices are really truncated, so the vertices are not part of the tetrahedra. And instead of the vertices, you have little triangles like this. So you get four such little triangles for each tetrahedron. And so the topology of the knot will give you a prescription of how to glue the faces pairwise. So for example, you take this face, you glue it in certain direction to that one, then you take the lower one, you glue it to another one, and so on. And so you can follow this from the topology. And once you've fully glued everything, the only thing that you're left with are the little triangles. And they all touch each other, which means that you're left with something like this. And this is the torus boundary around the knot. You identify opposite faces like this. So this is a triangulated torus at the boundary. And then the face space is determined by the holonomy eigenvalues on this knot. So for example, you take a path like this, which is the meridian. And then you have another path like this, which is the longitude. And then you have eigenvalues L and M. And this parameterizes the space of flat connections in this knot complement. So maybe you've heard of this A polynomial, which is a polynomial in L and M. And when you set it to zero, this is exactly the Lagrangian equation that gives you the flat connections. I can say that so for rank k, or for k M5 brains, you have a U1 to the k minus 1 flavor symmetry for those theories. And so this enhances to SUK on certain special point of the moduli space of marginal deformation. And what's interesting also is that those theories have it's an expectation. So yes, so your paper with Tudor is an example of how this can happen, but it's expected that this should happen more generally. So, well, this k minus one, actually. So you have a space of k minus one dimensional space of marginal deformation, and you expect that you move around. And at special points, you have this enhancement.
So
it's
the same dimension as the six dimensions.
Yes. So for KM5 brains, you know that there is order K cube octahedra in each of those. So the degrees of freedom, the number of degrees of freedom is roughly KQ, see in the large K limit, and this is exactly the expectation of how the free energy should scale for a theory from M5 brains. So this is a very sort of vague argument, but it would have to be made more precise to really see this KQ behavior of the free energy. Yes, it's true. Yeah, so this is one of the six k cubed minus one. And the subleading is just this minus k. It's exactly what you get in the anomaly polynomial worked out by Greg Moore and Harvey. and so on. So we were quite excited to see this. It's the same thing, but then it's not completely clear how to go from the anomaly polynomial in 6D to 3D, because in 3D you don't have those anomalies. So the computation was performed to relate the 6D anomaly polynomial to the 4D gauge theories by Alde, Itashikawa, and Benini, I think. So hopefully this can be, a similar computation can be done in that case. But we have to understand what replaces the anomalies in this case. It's probably some sort of Chern-Simons term and some anomaly parity that plays this role. But it has to be more precise. Yes? Yes. Yes.
So I guess it would be similar to the function of the rest of KK. There's a simple relation to the essential number.
And simple connection to what?
I mean, because there is a logarithm. The logarithm was for the series of series 4 times.
Yes.
The portion of the
hyperbolic space. Yes, yes. Yeah, we talked about this. Yes. Yeah.
Volume.
Yeah.
Which enters gets a true answer. So I'm following the
following. Yeah, certainly.
At least in the large K, the area is K in itself.
Yes. Well, but so the Chern-Simons partition function will reduce in the large K limit in to just the volume. Yes. Yes. So
this would be a very hard statement about the extremum of this volume or something like that.
Yes, so actually
the volume might put it down at equal to 1, which is a very
much. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so the F maximization in 3D gauge theories is dual to volume minimization in the geometry of the ADS dual. But what is interesting is that there's also another volume maximization procedure that's well known in hyperbolic geometry is that those Lagrangian conditions that I had written down, those equations here, they're hard to satisfy, to find a solution, but you can bypass this process by using an extremization procedure. So you write a volume in terms of those variables, and then you extremize this volume, and at this critical point, those Lagrangian conditions, which means you can extend the flat connections inside the three manifold, will be satisfied. So this is a. Sorry. Yeah, it's true. So the connections, but. Okay, I think that's about all I wanted to say. I can just mention a few directions. So, Yeah, so it would be interesting to have a better understanding of more the properties of those CFT that we get from such manifolds. So this is one example of what we can learn is that they have this this space of marginal deformation at which you have enhancement and this scaling of degrees of freedom and so on. But there should be more information that can be extracted from this process. And then we can also look at more elaborated three manifolds, so complements of not only one knot, but several knots, which are links or networks and things like this. It's also maybe possible to get some sort of graphical description of the CFTs in terms of some sort of quivers. And so the group Cecotti, Cordova, and Vaffa have some construction of such quivers in the case of 2M5 brains, and maybe this can be generalized to any number of M5 brains, and this will also provide some connection with the 4D theories, the higher rank 4D theories, which are those so-called spectral networks, which were studied by Davide Moore and Netzke. And yeah, there's this F maximization issue, and it would be nice also to identify the gravity duals of those solutions. So as Davide was saying, the ADS4 solution in M theory that corresponds to those CFTs. Okay, so I'll stop here. Yeah, it's just full defects. Yeah, there's also this. Sorry? Yes. I'm not sure I understand. So you're saying those quotients of hyperbolic space cannot describe more complicated.
Yeah. In the case of the two-dimensional case, Hedgehog surface is only full boundary. You just have the meaning of the same solution based on.
Yes. I see. Yeah, I mean the non-full punctures will, yeah, definitely be an issue to understand. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, it should be, yeah.
Which for static is steering. For any very large, that's not the way to get a big gap.
All right. Thank you.